2013 Pink Harvest was the largest on record. It's led to a glut of supply.
Millions of cases of Alaska pink salmon are sitting in inventory. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, 5,000 Alaskans have signed up for health insurance on healthcare.gov.
You know, I think it's a far cry from what we were hoping for the state of Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
There's a good feeling you get when you give, and each year more Alaskans are supporting things they love when they file online for their PFD. Alaskans like you donated $2.5 million last year to strengthen education, help families in need of food and shelter, and protect the most vulnerable among us. You even shared your permanent fund dividends with public radio to keep quality programming alive and well. This year, the PFD is expected to be a lot bigger. So come on, love Alaska. Pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
The U.S. Senate is considering two international treaties that Senator Lisa Murkowski says would help crack down on pirate fishing in the North Pacific. Murkowski today told the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee that illegal high seas fishing is an economic threat to the crab industry. The senator says it lowers the market price, costing legitimate harvesters more than $500 million since the year 2000.
As recently as 2011, NOAA law enforcement seized 112 metric tons of illegally harvested Russian king crab that was being shipped to U.S. markets through the Port of Seattle.
Murkowski says the illegal crab catch also deprived Alaska of millions in landing fees. One of the treaties aims to require countries to better police their ports to keep pirate vessels from unloading. The senator has a special interest in the Bering Sea crab fishery, made famous by the Deadliest Catch TV show. Murkowski says her son just finished a season working as a crab fisherman.
He's headed back home, and he's probably going to have some Bering Sea crab stories that I'm not sure that his mother is really ready to hear yet, but I'm bracing myself.
Both treaties had broad support at today's Senate hearing. There are three fishing companies that operate in Alaska have been fined about $275,000 by the Environmental Protection Agency for pollution violations stretching back to 2008. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal has more.
The EPA penalized Blue North Fisheries, the Fishing Company of Alaska, and Golden Fleece Incorporated for failing to monitor and record seafood waste discharges from four of their processing vessels. Blue North Fisheries and Golden Fleece also admitted to letting their Clean Water Act permits lapse for some of their boats, which means they were illegally emitting waste for a time. Processing vessels are allowed to dump their scraps of unwanted fish overboard, as long as they grind it up into small pieces as specified by the EPA first. They also have to keep tabs on the time and volume of those emissions and make sure they don't contain too much metal. The EPA didn't respond to a request for comment. Blue North Fisheries of Seattle agreed to pay almost $95,000 for seafood waste violations on two of their Bering Sea freezer longliners. Kenny Down, the company president, says they're not admitting to any excess pollution. Down declined to speak on tape, but he told KUCB that all of Blue North's violations are tied to bad record keeping and missing paperwork over the span of a few years. Down says the EPA is partially to blame for that because the agency went through, quote, a long period of non-enforcement, end quote. Golden Fleece Incorporated consists of one factory trawler called the Golden Fleece, which fishes in the Gulf of Alaska. They were fined $136,000 for dumping fish waste without a Clean Water Act permit for 3 years, among other violations. William Bisbee owns Golden Fleece. He says they've gotten new permits, but that hasn't made a difference in how much processing waste gets dumped overboard. All that's different is that the crew keeps a logbook and takes photographs of discharges and sends water samples out to the EPA every quarter. The Fishing Company of Alaska didn't respond to a request for an interview, but the company agreed to pay $44,000 in fines for inadequate record keeping, and they've now come in compliance with EPA standards. In on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
The record-setting pink salmon catch in Alaska last year has left seafood processing companies with several years' worth of inventory of canned product, although not all of the pink salmon winds up in a can. In fact, industry in recent years has been freezing and reprocessing around half of Alaska's pink catch. Analysts say that move has helped weather the boom and bust cycles of salmon returns. KFSK's Joe Vicknicki reports.
The 2013 pink harvest was the largest on record. It's led to a glut of supply, and we'll probably, there will be downward pressure on prices because of it. And it's really been a pretty tremendous impact.
That's Joe Jacobson, director of the state's Division of Economic Development, testifying before the House Fisheries Committee this month. Fishing fleets caught 219 million pink salmon in Alaska last year. That helped fill up an estimated 4 million cases of tall pink cans. And it's left companies with almost 5 million cases in inventory.
Even though the catch was big, we're not having any real problems moving through it.
Tom Sunderland is vice president of marketing for Ocean Beauty Seafoods, one of the companies that operates in the state. He says the demand for Alaska salmon seems to keep growing.
I mean, that isn't to say we don't have a lot of inventory. We do. We're in a heavy inventory position right now, and that's always a little worrisome when you're holding more inventory than you want, but it is selling well.
Companies say a can of salmon has a shelf life of about 6 years, so processors don't need to sell all of the 2013 catch right away. Andy Wink is a seafood analyst for the McDowell Group, a consulting firm that works with the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute.
Given where sales have been the last several years, we're looking at inventory of about 2.6 years in terms of how much supply do we have and how much inventory do we have. So that would take us, you know, beyond 2015. Even if we did not can, another salmon for the next couple of years.
Wink says a chronic oversupply brought prices down in the early 2000s.
And that made it very difficult, obviously, to sell new production. But, you know, through a lot of hard work, through a lot of marketing, and actually through just shifting a lot of product out of the can, we were able to bring that inventory down.
Pinks that don't end up in a can are often headed and gutted, then frozen and shipped overseas for more processing. That's become an increasing portion of the catch, according to the Institute of Social and Economic Research's Gunnar Knapp.
That has changed over the past few years, processors had increasingly started freezing the salmon and shipping it to the Far East, to countries like China and Vietnam and Thailand for reprocessing into value-added products.
The Department of Agriculture will be buying $20 million worth of canned pinks for food pantry programs across the country. That's an expanded purchase over past years, and it's a decision that was hailed by Alaska's senators back in January. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
Sport fishermen in the Matsu Borough are thrilled with the change the Alaska Board of Fisheries made this week to the Cook Inlet drift net fisheries. KTNA's Philip Manning reports.
On Monday, the State Board of Fisheries voted 7-0 to accept a change in regulations drafted by the Matsu Fish and Wildlife Commission. The new rule changes where and when the drift net fleet can go after sockeye and coho salmon. Now, drift fishermen would have an expanded early season until mid-July with another shorter session that begins on July 16th. Also, fishing would be moved primarily to the area near the Kenai and Kasiloff rivers. Mac Menard, a consultant with the Matsu Commission and longtime fish and game biologist, explains the theory behind the change.
That change in framework moved it from a large mixed stock style fishery management system to a terminal stock fishery management system in an effort to focus the commercial harvests on those very valuable and abundant Kenai and Kasiloff stocks, while at the same time creating a conservation quarter up the middle of the inlet to allow the passage of Northern District fish.
The idea is that by moving the fishery away from the center of the inlet, that it's less likely that silvers and reds bound for the Matsu rivers would be caught in the same nets as the far more abundant Kenai and Kasiloff reds. The new regulations were proposed as part of an effort to address the 7 stocks of concern in the Matsu Valley. Mac Menard says that there isn't much danger of the intensification of Kenai sockeye fishing harming that run in the near term.
Well, the Kenai Kasiloff sockeye fisheries have been very abundant. They're very prolific. They're very robust fisheries. And it has always been a challenge to be able to harvest that surplus and still afford conservation measures for Northern District fish.
Mac Menard says that the impact of the new rules could be seen this summer as fewer Susitna-bound silvers and reds are caught and make it through the newly established conservation corridor. Conservation has been the Matsu Fish and Wildlife Commission's rallying cry throughout this process. Mac Menard and other commissioners have argued that the goal is not to immediately have Valley fishermen bring home more salmon. Instead, he hopes it will strengthen the run in the future. Talkeetna-based fishing guide Todd Kingery agrees.
This is something looking for the future. I mean, in order for you to get more fish, obviously you got to let more fish in so they can spawn. Hopefully you get a higher survival rate and bigger returns. And so this will be something sustainable years down the road.
While the Board of Fisheries has passed the new drift gill net regulations, there's always the possibility that commercial fishing groups could mount a legal challenge. While no word has come out yet on whether that option is being considered, the United Cook Inlet Drift Association is already fighting a legal battle to attempt to have all management of the inlet taken from the state and given over to the federal government. Until the dust settles on the latest salvo in the fish wars, however, sports fishermen and Matsu officials say they have a lot to be happy about. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, cataloging the life of an Alaskan with many talents.
72, I think he was, when he broke his neck in six places doing a backflip on stage.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the 2014 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com.
And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The state of the judiciary address can sometimes be a lofty affair, where the head of the state Supreme Court sets out a vision for what justice in Alaska should look like. This year, Alaska Supreme Chief Justice Dana Fabe delved into more pragmatic concerns, like the effect of declining revenues on the state legal system.
It means working smart and doing more with less so that we can continue to operate in the manner the Constitution requires of us, even in the face of budget constraints.
Fabe highlighted the work of retired justices who fill in to help manage caseloads and the money the state is saving by filing documents electronically. State lawmakers wrapped their knuckles on their desks as a form of applause when Fabe noted the court system had found other ways to pay for a sobriety program and was returning a $40,000 legislative appropriation. This was Fabe's eighth address to the Alaska legislature. More than 5,000 Alaskans have signed up for health insurance on the federal marketplace. The new numbers released today include enrollments through the beginning of the month and show a 30% jump since the end of December. Tyann Bowling is CFO of Enroll Alaska. She says she's seeing at least a small increase in enrollments, even in the last week. Still, Bowling is not impressed.
You know, I think it's a far cry from what we were hoping for the state of Alaska.
Bowling hoped the state would sign up 20,000 people for health insurance by the end of the year. She thinks the troubled rollout of healthcare.gov made that difficult, if not impossible, to accomplish. Bowling also says there are still a lot of Alaskans who don't know about the Affordable Care Act.
That's always been our greatest challenge, and it remains our greatest challenge. I think that, you know, we've done okay with getting the message out about us in the Anchorage area and some of our larger communities, but truly the challenge is to get people to understand what it means to them, what the benefit is for them, and just to have them call to get a consultation.
The federal report on enrollment includes figures for Medicaid. Alaska Governor Sean Parnell decided not to expand Medicaid in the state. But despite that, healthcare.gov has determined about 2,500 Alaskans are eligible for existing Medicaid coverage. Ron Creer directs the Division of Public Assistance. He says the number of Alaskans discovering they qualify for Medicaid is in line with what the department was anticipating. He's pleased more low-income Alaskans are going to get the health care they need.
It matters a great deal. I mean, it means that there's, you know, roughly another 2,500 Alaskans that are going to receive health care services and access to health care that they may well not have had previously.
Creer says about 150,000 Alaskans are covered through Medicaid. The open enrollment period for signing up for insurance on healthcare.gov lasts through March 31st. It's a deadline Alaskans should know well, since it's also the date permanent fund dividend applications are due. Spending on construction projects in Alaska is expected to increase this year, according to the University of Alaska's Institute of Social and Economic Research. KDLG's Mike Mason has the details.
The 2014 construction spending forecast was put together by the ICER researchers for the Associated General Contractors of Alaska. The researchers believe that construction spending in both the private and public sectors will top about $9.2 billion this year. That's up 18% compared to last year's spending level. ICER notes that most of the growth in the private construction spending will come from the oil and gas industry. The forecast is that the private sector will spend over $4.2 billion this year on construction projects. That's up 33% compared to 2013. According to the forecast, ConocoPhillips is scheduled to do quite a bit of exploratory drilling this year, including developing the large CD5 satellite, while BP has announced an expanded capital program this year that includes well workovers in the Prudhoe Bay field. The other major oil company, ExxonMobil, is expected to continue the work developing the Point Thompson field. The forecast also outlines the exploratory and development work planned for this year by several smaller oil and gas companies, including Eni, Pioneer, Brooks Range Petroleum, Repsol, and Link Petroleum. The recent uptick in activity in Cook Inlet is expected to continue. The forecast notes that Hillcorp, which recently purchased the assets of Chevron and Unocal, plans to drill about 10 new wells this year. Other companies expected to be active this year in Cook Inlet include Buccaneer, Fury, and Cook Inlet Energy. While construction spending by oil and gas companies is expected to be up this year, spending by mining companies is expected to be down, with a forecasted total of $205 million. The researchers with ICER suggest that the drop in the price of gold is one of the reasons for the drop in spending. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The Yukon Quest has once again proven itself as one of the toughest races in the far north. Of the 18 mushers who signed up for this year's race, only 11 may finish. The race has claimed rookies and seasoned veterans alike, but there are still a handful of teams plugging along toward the finish line outside of Whitehorse. KUAC's Emily Schwing caught up with the Kiwi musher and has this profile.
The Yukon Quest Trail can be a lonely, solitary route. And with the way this year's field spread out early, it was even more so. But rookie Kurt Pirano says that's how he likes to travel.
When I'm running a race, I like to just do my own thing and not be influenced by what other people do or say. If I do bump into other people, no problem, but I will probably make an effort to try and adjust my schedule to break away.
Pirano hasn't spent much time near other teams. He did break trail with Dave Dalton on a run between Eagle and Dawson City after high winds and falling snow drifted in the trail.
And you do that when the time is right, but I'm not really one to travel in big groups.
Because he's running his team alone, he does find ways to pass the time.
I just work. I get my ski pole out or something like that, because I find if I just stand there, my eyes are open, but I'm not seeing what's in front of me. I'm just seeing weird things and thinking weird things, very, very random stuff. So I know when I really need to focus, I'll get my ski pole out and I'll work with the dogs.
He also plugs in his iPod every now and again.
It's random. I like the heavier stuff. So
heavier stuff like heavy metal?
And rock and, a bit of everything.
He and wife Fleur moved to the United States in 2007 and then to Alaska 2 years ago because Pirano wanted to start running his dogs for much longer distances. He's run 2 Iditarods. He's planning a third run to Nome this year. When he was back at the Circle checkpoint, he said he chose the Quest this year for a change of pace.
That's another trail to run with the dogs, really. I've never run up this part of the country, so why not?
And he's not the only rookie on his team. He says he's impressed with a 3-year-old dog named Croc.
But I got one young guy there we bred. This is his first race, and I was a bit unsure, but he's happy and having fun, and he hasn't made a mistake yet. He's done a great job, so that's rewarding.
But Croc and the rest of Pirano's team didn't seem to come together until the back half of the race. Veterinarians were impressed when his team came into CarMax, but he says that wasn't the case early on.
I left the start line with something missing, and, they were really lacking something for a long way into the race. And so I really kind of took a step back so I could try and regroup them and get them happy and get them working. And they were starting to kick into gear maybe 70 miles before Dawson, And in the last, I guess, 100 or so, they're really starting to look nice and the attitudes are really good.
With five teams in front and five teams behind, Kurt Pirano is likely to finish solo, right in the middle of the pack. On the Yukon Quest Trail, I'm Emily Schwing in CarMax.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
When someone dies, it can take months to sort out legal and personal matters. But if that life encompassed more than 70 years of international stage performances?
This is a few of the 3,000 or 4,000 photos and newspaper clippings and memorabilia that Mike left in my care.
Russ Reno's decades of friendship with dancer, acrobat, and longtime Anchorage resident Mike Medill ended when Medill died last September, leaving boxes full of memories from his life as a dancer and singer. As Reno pulls up some of the hours of video he has, it's clear that he truly admired Medill's performance skill.
Let's see here. Go to YouTube. I uploaded it to YouTube. Here's the Lucky Strike Hit Parade.
As extra, the Hit Parade dancers featuring Bobby Felice are in a flirtatious mood as they step out to their all-time favorite, Dinah.
The thing about Mike that you could tell right away that he was performing is because of his classical background. He would go to point, everything was spot on.
He started as a child performer and had a career that spanned decades.
From the early 1930s clear up to till recent, to 2013. And I thought I knew him. I mean, I've known him for most of my life, but I thought I knew him, and I was just shocked how much I didn't know about him.
Reno runs a tourism business from a cramped office across the street from the Hilton Hotel in downtown Anchorage. He called Medill uncle and said his favorite expression was, "You're only as good as what you do tomorrow," which may explain why Reno learned so much after the modest performer died. As he digs through memorabilia, Reno says Medill never bragged, but he could have.
That was just amazing when he would talk about it. He would be so matter-of-fact about things. You know, we're looking through this pile here. Here's an original NBC script. This one here is, I think, from the 1950s. Here is Paramount Studios. This is when he was in For Whom the Bell Tolls. We've got a...
He also could have dropped well-known names.
We've got old telegrams from... That is Sammy Davis Jr., and wishing him well when his first night at Radio City Music Hall, he and Gil Johnson were headlining Radio City.
He started in television on the Milton Berle and Patti Page shows. Medill had a twin sister he performed with in the early years. His legal name was Percy, hers Gertrude. They didn't care for those, so on stage they went with Rusty and Rita.
And they're named the Sunshine Twins, as they had used many times on stage. Rusty and Rita went on and toured. They even took an airplane flight with Amelia Earhart when she was coming through California.
If you're not retirement age, you may not know the Lucky Strike Hit Parade, Nat King Cole, or Eartha Kitt, but you get the point. Mike Medill was well-known and well-traveled. A vaudeville performer, Medill developed curriculum for Chico State University in California and taught dance to students like Morgan Freeman. For rehearsals, he hired a young man for $2 an hour named Liberace. Reno's task is daunting, given the number of boxes of fragile documents, but he's determined.
You can tell by the ones we haven't done already, they're curling up like crazy, and you can see here that they're just, you know, if we don't do them soon, they're starting to crack and everything else, so we're trying our best to get them all preserved.
He says Mike Medill never stopped embracing new ideas.
Mike also had two doctorates. He found time to go to school at the same time. He also had a third honorary doctorate degree from the President of Mexico.
He signed up to fight in World War II after a heckler ridiculed his astounding onstage acrobatics, saying he should put his talent to work defending the country. He was 17, but looked older. Embarrassed by the encounter, he forged his parents' signature and went to war, resuming his dance career after his service ended in 1946. By his early 20s, he'd traveled to 30 different countries. In Alaska, he taught dance at UAA and UAF. Reno says even after a severe injury in his 70s, he didn't slow down.
72, I think he was, when he broke his neck in six places doing a backflip on stage. As soon as he got out of his body cast, he started working out and getting in his garden and taking walks and soon went back to work. That's when he went to work on the North Slope, started cooking. And then that's like a year later, he went to work for Princess and Hall American and started touring.
After the broken neck?
Oh, all after the broken neck, yeah.
Mike Medill went back to college at 76 and became a probation officer for the state. Even though Russ Reno has cross-referenced thousands of articles to verify Medill's prolific performance life, incredibly, he's still looking.
The only thing I wish we had more of was them as the Sunshine Twins. That's been the hardest thing to prove. We still haven't found, if anybody knows out there, Aunt Polly's Radio Hour, 1937, possibly that one also sponsored by Wonder Bread. Still not sure on that, though. Verdict's still out.
Russ Reno misses his uncle Mike Medill. He says Medill worked until a week before he died at 88, even though he liked to pretend he was 10 years younger. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Joe Viknicki in Petersburg, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Emily Schwing in Whitehorse. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Kristen Platt is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.gov. It's time for the Healthy Futures Challenge. Pull out the jump ropes or go sledding with the family and get out and play. Get moving with activities the whole family enjoys. Find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. Healthy kids are happy kids. Inspire your kids to get out and play every day. For more ways to get active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. Whether it has to do with fishing, food, or fun, every Alaskan has a story about their connection with wild salmon. And you're invited to hear some of those stories. Introducing Salmon Voices, a new series from the Salmon Project. It features Alaska authors, photographers, and illustrators sharing their experiences with Alaska's most famed fish. New stories will be published each day, February 2nd through the 16th, on alaskadispatch.com. This message is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.